one of the Hausa teachers, he also recommended in a certain way, and also we had some listeners' experience where he said that it was his first time to pray Namaz-e-Jafar-e-Tayyar during the month of Shaban or something, and before Fajr Namaz.
Yes.
And whenever after praying that Namaz, his behavior with his wife, with his behavior with his family, completely changed. Okay. And one of the things that was confirmed was this, that if you pray Namaz-e-Jafar-e-Tayyar, you will feel your essence in your daily Namaz, daily prayers.
That's right.
Like the five-time prayer that we
pray. So these are the preparations before the holy month of Ramadan.
Yeah. So once you you have like cleared out yourself, the difference you'll find out before the holy month of Ramadan. The moment you start approaching the month of Ramadan, you will feel the essence of fasting much more convenient and much more lack of distraction and discomfort. Because one of the reasons, as they say this, is we to bring ourselves closer to the poor. It's one of the acts where the rich and the poor are on the same stage.
Yes.
You see?
That's right.
And when you fast, you are similar to the poor and you feel the hunger and the pain of the hunger and thirst that you feel over
the
there.
The society.
Yeah. That's so you become a part of society, a bigger society.
Yes, that's all right. Okay. Thank you very much, Brother Suhail, for a elaboration of fasting of the Muslims. Why do Muslims fast? How to have a better quality fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Eyes of Truth.
Palestine is of great importance to the world's media because of the events and developments that take place there every day. The Israeli occupation leaves no room for the Palestinians to spend a single day without inconveniences, and it does it through various means of repression, murder, confiscation of land, and desecration of sacred sites. And it makes it look like the Palestinians are the bad guys and the Israelis the good ones. This campaign of deliberate misinformation continued for decades until the day came that the Palestinians could provide a narrative that debunked that of the occupation. Through local media, they reached out to the world, communicating their message, all the while aware of the risks involved.
As we know, there are a number of attempts to control countries by occupying the headquarters of television or the occupation of public broadcasters. Israel was working on this aspect to hit the Palestinian media from the first moment through the creation of fear. These steps have failed as of the start and middle and end of this operation because Palestinian media was ever present, always at the scene. They plan for every upcoming Israeli operation, and the way we can tell something is going on is when Israel starts to attack or bomb the media and bring about fear and confusion.
Israel's branding of itself before the civilized world is a civilized and developed country with a national humanitarian project. I think the Palestinian press has managed and operated first and foremost based on a national theme dedicated to the homeland and national responsibility. We portray the image as it is. When Israel targets civilians and children, bombards houses, mosques, hospitals, organizations, and besieges an entire people, we inform the civilized and free world about what Israel is doing. O civilized people and free nations, this is what Israel is doing to us.
What distinguished Al-Aqsa Media Channel in this war was the influence it had on the Zionist front. We were able, by the grace of God Almighty, to infiltrate Zionist media channels and broadcast to the resistance. As you know, the Zionist government and media follow Al-Aqsa Space Channel, and this is confirmed by a Zionist analyst. We could enter homes outside Palestine on TV and radio and show how the resistance succeeded. And this got into the minds of the Zionist enemy within their own homes and influence their policies as part of the psychological warfare that took place in the 2014
war. This is what the Zionist occupation did not want their own people and the people of the world to see, that the Palestinian press has credibility over the news coming out of the Zionist press, which came from statements made by Israeli settlers. They don't have credibility, but the people believe Palestinian media, and this is the fruit of our determination and perseverance.
يعني هذه النظرية لم تأتي من فراغ بل أتت من مثابرة وأتت من تصميم.
The Israeli occupation and its army first tried to keep the media away from the scenes of carnage during the 2014 Gaza war. But when that didn't work, they went after the journalists. Some of the most important facilities destroyed by the Israeli occupation in 2014 were the five Al-Aqsa Media Network facilities.
The headquarters at Burj al-Shuruq Financial Management Office, the offices at Al Nasr, and the office you are at now were all targeted, as well as the broadcast center.
We all felt like this was the end of us when the broadcaster was targeted. But we don't believe that we are more important than our children and our homes, and the future of Palestine and our feelings do not shy away from embarrassment. Our purpose is that our message to the people should not be disrupted, because we believe they need us every second. We were back on air after a few hours of the attack, which was met with a positive response from the community.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network had aired resistance operational information that allowed the Palestinian resistance to defeat a group of Israeli soldiers. An operational failure for Israel was not an option, and so they had to put a stop to the leaking of the truth to the outside world, and then to replace the truth by way of omission or denial.
Repeat with me, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty. No true God but Allah. Al-Qassam brigades have just captured a soldier. Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, praise to be Allah. Let those wounded people at Al-Shaja'iyya rejoice tonight as Al-Qassam brigades capture the soldier.
Those words that prompt me to stand and salute Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades and the souls of their hero martyrs, I greet you from the heart. This is a victory speech that we have started sharing on this blessed night. All respect and salute is due to the Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades. We will start commentating after a short interval. Stay tuned. That which was reflected through this war, that the Palestinian narrative is credible when it comes to news, we were keen about that. When the Zionist enemy said that five people were killed, we would replay the same information, but without exaggeration of such, reporting that in fact 50 were killed, and we believed that the narrative of the resistance that we knew was genuine. When the Qassam Brigade said they killed eight Israeli soldiers in Nahal Az, we published it, and this was validated by the Zionist enemy later when they were forced to then confess that indeed eight of their soldiers were killed. We believe the resistance narrative because they are entitled to be believed.
We believe we have a revolutionary privacy that distinguishes us from others. Frankly, we all received threatening letters to the order that several houses of colleagues were pounded with bombs. One of our colleagues in radio was bombed directly by an F-16 fighter jet. This man was a journalist who was not engaging in any resistance but targeted due to his employment.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network was but one of 19 media organizations broadcasting from the Gaza Strip, which were bombed, leaving them partially or totally destroyed. Al-Shaab Radio was one such network building reduced to rubble.
We tried to take with us some devices, such as a transmitter, which is an expensive device that a radio broadcast relies on. I remember at one time, a colleague started to walk upstairs when all of a sudden an unmanned drone fired rockets at our building. We had to escape the building with no time to take anything with us, not even archives or any electronic device. Conditions were extremely bad when we were leaving, as some were injured due to the panic and stumbling around at 3 o'clock in the morning, seeing nothing in front of them. The tower we worked in, after being hit, collapsed into debris. When we couldn't grab anything from inside the radio station, we thought we had lost our important archives. We believed we had lost a voice for the people, months of work.
Another Palestinian media organization assaulted by the Israeli forces was a national agency which provides services to local and international TV stations. This particular site was filmed by a surveillance camera while under attack by Israeli warplanes that let fly several missiles which decimated the area, compelling and hard evidence of a war crime.
We were offering round-the-clock coverage of the deadly night, which they targeted more than 30 houses throughout the Gaza Strip. Many people were displaced from their homes in the north and in El Shajaya. We're not targeted as journalists individually, but they bombed our whole building, bringing it down with three missiles. It means the occupation is trying to silence media, audio and images. It's a crime. They want to kill the journalists in one hit. There were 36 journalists inside the building at the time. They targeted the building with no prior warning so that we had no chance to evacuate the building beforehand.
It's natural for journalists to be frightened, cautious, and not want to stay long in places that clearly are a potential target of Israeli missiles. Many evacuated from their news desks and resorted to working out of hotels in their continued efforts to write and prevent their words and video footage from being silenced by the invading Israeli forces.
I come from Khan Yunis city. I had to move to Gaza because of the very harsh security situation. As a journalist, I come to stay in a hotel where I am sure I can provide the needed life and life coverage services to the to Press TV. I was injured in 1 in the morning. I was attending my work. I was doing this work in an area that is known to be full of journalists from the different media outlets, including some foreign journalists who are doing some live coverage and media coverage in general for some international and regional media channels. This is the area where I was targeted and injured. And where I sustained my injuries, I tried my best to stay awake. I tried my best also to establish what was happening, but it was far beyond my capacity because of the very strong explosion and because of the surprise and because of the injury.
Palestinian journalists continued to deliver audio and video reports during the war that so displeased the Israeli government and military, it issued a statement which Palestinian journalists interpreted as a preface to direct targeting.
What happened is that Israel, prior to targeting the first journalist in the Gaza Strip, Hamid Shahab, through their media office, issued a public statement ordering foreign journalists who had entered the Gaza Strip to go to the beach hotel for sanctuary. We issued an immediate statement telling Palestinian journalists that it meant they were being targeted as long as they were not included in the statement. That was our perception of this.
On the eve of July 9, 2014, the first Israeli aerial bombardment took place in what is considered the high-class neighborhood of Al-Rimal in Gaza City. The target of the raid was an automobile carrying a sign that read "Press" on it and driven by journalist Hamid Shahab with co-worker Hatim Selmi at his side. They had stopped by Hatim's home to briefly check on his family, whom he had not seen in a while. Shahab remained in the car outside. A minute or two later, while Hatim was with his family, a missile hit their home, and Hamid Shahab lost his partner.
I was at the office working for the fourth day in a row without going home. I went then, returned home, had a bath, and changed my clothes. I saw my family, but decided not to see my mother as I knew she would become too emotional. You know how mothers get after their sons are away for a while. Hamid phoned me to say he was coming to my home. I went to the balcony to watch for him, but he said he couldn't see me. He told me he was entering the street, and I was looking down both sides to find him. He entered from the Kazim area, from the opposite lane, because he was coming from Al Sabra neighborhood. So he said he is now in the street, and I told him I saw him and ended the call. I was going downstairs. My mother was there, and she commented that she had not seen me in a while and that she missed me. I was touched and moved back to kiss her hands and head, and I was about to hold my brother's hand when there was a huge explosion.
It was Ramadan, and we were leaving the mosque after Taraweeh prayers. We sat with my cousins and a few uncles next to a press vehicle. Another car parked behind us to pick up Hatim Selmi, a journalist who was upstairs. The driver's mobile rang, and the next thing I was aware of, we all woke up at the hospital.
I held one victim in my arms, but he was lifeless. I moved to the next, and they too were dead. Then another and another. I wanted to work my way through those that died so that I may find someone alive to rescue. The injured I could help. The driver was nowhere to be found. The car was unrecognizable. The explosion was so severe. I searched for the driver, but found nothing until a first aid officer found his legs and half of his abdomen. The car suffered a direct hit. It was indeed the target. I imagined myself sitting next to him when the explosion occurred, cut to ribbons, dying together as martyrs.
As the war on Gaza continued, The targeting of journalists, too, continued and escalated. Israeli occupational forces assassinated 6 journalists, all in 1 month, prompting many other journalists to go into hiding.
I would often warn him, but he always insisted on venturing out to film and record the truth for the world to see. It was in his blood, and he worked passionately day and night. The only time you knew he was alive was when he would call and tell us he is in a certain place and safe.
He would film the martyrs and help carry the injured on his searching to find them all. He used to come home asking about me and my day. He hid his blood-stained clothes from me because he knows I have high blood pressure and diabetes. He didn't want me to feel upset.
Rami was very courageous. Whenever I saw him putting on his helmet and vest, I would ask, "Where are you going?" He would say he was going to do his job and show the truth to the world. I reminded him that we have young children that need their father, but he always said, "What's meant to happen will happen. We can't lock him in a room."
Rami Ryan did not respond to calls from his parents and wife to stay home and not cover the war and go out in search of crimes being committed by the Israeli aggressors. Rami is a photographer and an only son. He is married with 4 children, and his job supports them all, the whole family. Rami's family, like other families of journalists, worried incessantly every time a bombing or massacre occurred. It was a traumatic time for all.
I had my child Rami after 14 years of marriage. I spoiled and doted upon him as he was my only son. He married after high school and had 2 girls and 2 boys. I always scolded him, saying he is an only son and all would be lost if someone were to knock on my door and tell me something happened to him. May he rest in peace. He never listened to me. His work was a message he had to deliver, even if the price was his blood. He was prepared to die for the cause.
I phoned him in his last days. He was away so much, and I told him that he needs to come home and spend time with his children, as they missed him so. He promised to come home early that night, and he did come, and we ate dinner together. He showed us some of what he had filmed, horrible scenes from his trips accompanying the PRCS as they evacuated displaced people from Ash-Shaja'iyya.
The last time I saw him, I was in afternoon prayer and he was about to leave. I raised my voice saying, "Allahu Akbar," to make him wait. Then he came to the window side and waited. Once I finished my prayers, I told him that his kids are still young and that because of the risk he was taking, that one day he would die in the blink of an eye. He told me that Allah will look after them and told me that if I locked him in a box, he would die. So it's better that he lives as he was meant to. I told him that he exhausted me with worry, but that he's also right in what he said.
One day, Rami journeyed out to cover a massacre in Al-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. His photos taken at the site were the last images he ever took. Scores of rockets and missiles rained down on the same area after the initial massacre, and Rami was martyred.
The incident of injuring and killing and murdering Rami Rayyan in Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood when the Israeli occupation forces targeted the market, killing with the deceased Rami more than 17 people from Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. That was another evidence that our job is full of risks and that our life is at the stake, but that also that surprised us, but that also made us determined that we are the guards of the truth.
Rami's family lost their son, husband, father, and sole breadwinner. The only consolation for the family members is that Rami died exposing the truth, embedded in the photographs he took of the massacres and other crimes committed against the Palestinian people.
May he rest in peace. He has been martyred, which is a privilege. Praise the Lord that he was chosen. He was a kind-hearted and a good man. There is nothing worse, though, than when a child asks you, "Where is her father?" You might answer that he's in paradise, but then the child says, when it rains, dad will get wet, and so he should come here to stay warm with us. You answer that it won't rain on him, as the Lord protects him in paradise, where he has everything.
The war in Gaza lasted for 51 days. By the end, dozens of journalists had been killed or injured. Witnesses to Israel's great loss over its battle to monopolize and control media exposure, which severely damaged its reputation on the world stage. Witnesses to the success of Palestinian resistance in the face of one of the largest and most technologically advanced armies in the world today.
Here there are 7 martyrs and about 30 wounded. Of the wounded, some have permanent disabilities. In every war by Israeli aggression, there's a great sacrifice from the Palestinian media sector, and I can tell you that we have no problem in giving our souls freely to expose the hellish barbarism of the Zionist regime.
We have lost in this war 18 brothers from the family of the press in Gaza. If journalists didn't put their lives on the line to expose Israel's crimes, if they did not succeed in this mission to be the messengers of the occupied peoples, then they would have not been targeted by the Israeli army. I think the Palestinian press succeeded in their endeavors that shows their love for their homeland.
There was a distant challenge this time in that the Palestinian media became a serious counterweapon versus the Western-dominated Israeli media and narrative. We were able to refute their narrative of lies and manipulation of the truth this time. They overrode our signal, but we broadcasted from other stations. When Al Shaab radio station was targeted, the Al Quds station was saying, here is Al Shaab voice from the studios of Al Quds station. When Watan and Al-Aqsa stations were targeted, we said we were their voice. We made it clear if they targeted one studio that the whole Gaza radio network would all be the voice for Al-Quds or Al-Shaab or any other Palestinian station attacked. We think we succeeded in this battle to make the truth in war prevail and to successfully counter many of the lies broadcasted as Israeli propaganda.
Even if a war erupted right now, we will still continue our work. For instance, I'm from the neighborhood of Beit Hanun, where almost every family has been displaced. My family stayed initially in a collective center. Our house was targeted, and thirdly, my place of work at Al-Watania Media was taken out by a missile. It took me just 4 hours to get back to my duties. Every journalist is subject to risks, just as the families and the thousands of children displaced. I didn't see my family for 52 days. Even when injured, I kept on working. Palestinian journalists are fierce workers in their dedication to expose the occupation in all its aspects.
Almost immediately after the war came to an end, media personnel returned to their offices to work, and staff of the destroyed networks found new premises to set up in and continue their brave cause.
As soon as the radio station was bombed by an Israeli airstrike, we were back in the saddle coming up with ways to get back on air reporting events. Even with the loss of the archive and the old premises of Al-Shaab, we started working and thinking of how to revive our efforts despite the sustained risks. Nothing will stop us from our path to serve the Palestinian cause.
Al-Aqsa radio station represented the resistant media, a voice that will never run out of means to continue. We have infinite alternatives and options that the enemy is not even aware of. Our signals will never be permanently ended. With Allah's will, we will return to the airwaves, always, one time more than we are knocked down.
They may have killed or deported journalists, but their pictures are immortal witnesses to all the horrendous atrocities committed by the Israeli occupation on Palestinian soil.
We are with you. What about you? Thoughtful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
The U.S. dollar slides as Fed rate hike outlook tumbles, following the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank recently. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the U.S. dollar index, which measures the greenback against six other major currencies, plunged to near one-month lows recently following a Goldman Sachs forecast that Washington will likely halt rate hikes. According to trading data, the index slid 0.6% to 103.9. Goldman previous forecast predicted a 25 basis point hike at the next Fed meeting in March. The change in expectations came after U.S. regulators recently announced a new emergency program aimed at protecting bank clients following the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank last week. According to a joint statement from U.S. Treasury, Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, they will make a systematic risk exception to allow both insured and uninsured depositors of the failed banks to regain full access to their money. The Fed also separately announced it would make additional funding available for banks in cases of emergency through a new bank term funding program. The measures led investors to predict the Fed may be too busy sorting through the fallout of the bank's failures to raise interest rates in the near term. There is a historic correlation between higher interest rates and failures of over-leveraged financial institutions. Over-leveraging occurs when a business has borrowed too much money and is unable to pay interest payments, principal repayments, or maintain payments for operating expenses due to its debt burden. However, analysts say U.S. inflation data release may also affect the Fed's rate hike plans. The Fed hiked the key rate on more than one occasion in recent months in a bid to rein in soaring inflation. The latest 25 basis point increase was announced on February 1st, bringing the rate to a target range of 4.5%. to 4.75%. Prior to last week, analysts expected at least three more rate hikes this year to bring the indicator to a peak of 5.25% to 5.5%. The New York Times also noted Signature Bank, a New York financial institution with a big real estate lending business that had recently made a play to win cryptocurrency deposits, closed its doors abruptly after regulators said that keeping the bank open could threaten the stability of the entire financial system in the U.S. To some extent, Signature is a victim of the panic around Silicon Valley Bank, which regulators seized. Its closing underscores the challenges that face small and mid-sized banks, which often focus on niche lines of business and have a narrower base of customers than Goliath like JP Morgan Chase or Bank of America. That leaves them especially vulnerable to old-fashioned bank runs.
Silicon Valley Bank, a lender to startups, imploded recently after some ill-timed financial decisions left it struggling to meet customer withdrawal requests. And just as a slowing venture capital funding prompted fledgling companies to tap their accounts more. Similarly, Signature became one of the few banks to welcome cryptocurrency deposits just before the overheated industry blew up last year. As word about Silicon Valley Bank's troubles began to spread last week, business customers of Signature began calling the bank, asking if their deposits were safe. Many were worried that their deposits could be at risk because, like business customers of Silicon Valley, most had more than $250,000 in their accounts. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the entity that sees Silicon Valley, insures deposits only up to $250,000. In announcing the closure of Signature, regulators said that customers of both banks would be made whole regardless of how much they held in their accounts. Many depositors at these banks are small businesses, including those driving the innovation economy, and their success is key to New York's robust economy, Governor Katie Hochul of New York said in a statement. But recently, with customers panicking about their money, Signature saw a torrent of deposits leaving its coffers, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. Its stock, along with the stocks of some of its peers, also continued to tank. Still, the bank's leaders expected to be able to weather the storm because the outflows had slowed, the person said, when regulators told bank executives that they were effectively seizing the bank, which had 40 branches across the country. Some of them were shocked. In shuttering the bank, New York bank regulators, acting in concert with the FDIC, also removed its executive team. The demise of Signature, with assets of under $100 billion, is a blow to many of the professional services firms that have come to rely on it. The bank, long specialized in providing banking services to law firms, providing escrow accounts for holding clients' money and other services.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Today we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Nakavi is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, and we have had this pleasure to have him in the studio. We, in this program, discuss your problems, questions related to the Islamic upbringing and different topics which have a very great deal with the Islamic upbringing of children. And the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his family, may peace be upon them. Well, Professor, in our previous episode, you said that love is not something that you only see the good part of the story, but there's also some bad part of the story. Don't you think the children who grow up with the concept that love is all to be on cloud nine and love is all to be, you know, seeing good of the other person always, and then when they get into a relationship, when they get into a married relationship, they actually face serious problems when they actually see other part of the partner as well. Do you think this problem mostly exists with the children who have not been actually brought up the way? Understanding love includes all. As you said in previous episode, that Allah sees everything and still He loves us.
Yes, very so, because most of the time, most of the times when we enter into a relationship with the opposite sex especially, it's because of the apparent features. We don't go deep down into the character and personality of the other person. Apparently there's all good feelings around, and we deem those good feelings to be feelings of love and compassion, but that's not the case. It's basically based on our instincts that we reach out to the opposite sex because we are inclined to do so as human beings having those animal instincts. But the human part, which is above that, which is which can take a person above the
to level higher levels,
to higher levels, and even above the levels of angels.
Yeah,
that human nature, that true divine nature, that beautiful nature. Of course, those instincts are part of that. It's a whole package. Those instincts are also a part of that beautiful creation of Allah Almighty. They have to be there. You cannot negate them. You cannot say, no, we don't want that. When we're talking about those feelings of apparent compassion and love and whatever we feel, that is also a necessary part of our character, of our personality. That is required. But if we want to have a good relationship, we have a positive relationship, a constructive relationship, we have to see both aspects. There's no human being who's going to be perfect in all aspects, but when we are going for a relationship, we should not go after the apparent features. People who are, for example, the celebrities, for example, they are supposed to make themselves look good because they get paid for looking good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's their job, it's their profession.
Yeah.
They want to promote
but
themselves.
But this never means that their entire life is this.
They may have a very, I mean, deep down, they may be not good people. They may be greedy people. They may be people who are deceitful, who are whatever. So it's not just apparent features you're attracted to. That is also, as I said, a part of it, but it's not the whole part. The whole part is below the surface. And what we should be looking for in other people, especially for the sake of entering into a
married
relationship
life.
And a married life, it is important that we see that true character inside, the knowledge, the positive feelings and emotions one has. Can I live with a person who is always looking down to me, down upon me as a second-rate thing, who he or she wants to manipulate for his or her own self? I mean, I need a person who can empathize with me, who can feel with me, who can have is accepting how I feel.
Yeah.
If a person is always wanting to impose his feelings and thoughts upon others, I can't bear such a person.
Yeah.
So I need to find out if that person is such. Maybe in the beginning he or she is showing off himself or herself to impress me, but at the later down the road I'm going to get into problems. So I have to find the real person inside. And of course, every human being has positives and negative aspects. You need to understand those, because when you go into marriage, for example, then you can't
change it. You actually come across a lot of things and you understand a lot of stuff that you have never understood before. Well, Professor, we would like to talk more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing about love that we teach to our children, that we need to teach to our children. So, Professor Nakavi, you have helped us understand that we got to teach our children to love people the way Allah loves us. Allah also sees our bad part. Allah also sees our worst part. And still He forgives us. Still He is with us. Still He showers His blessings over us all the time. So, but we are not, we fail to make people understand this. We fail to make our children actually realize this, that you got to be loving people. You got to be accepting others with their bads. So how is it possible? What makes it easy for us as parents to teach this thing to our children?
It is important that we practice what we claim and profess. When I want to show how I love, how my child should love others, I should show him or her that how I am loving him or her. How do I express my feelings to him? Sometimes we go to the extremes. Either it's, we completely forget the wrongdoings of our children and we start, you know, pampering them and, you know, supporting them in every wrong activity they do. That is one extreme. The other extreme is that we scold them for each and every wrongdoing they do. So these are two extreme things which happens, which happen.
And that's what kind of mentality they develop as they grow up.
But when we keep to the middle path and we say that we express our love for them, we express that we...
And we be moderate.
We say that we love you, but we don't like the action which you did. And as we said previously, the action which we do not like is because we want to show to him or our child that we love him and therefore we don't want him to do something wrong because that is which is going to affect his... character, which is going to have a bearing on his life. We don't want him to go down that wrong path.
Yeah.
So we say, despite the fact that you're doing, we love you, but we don't want you to do such and such thing because it will be diminishing for your character, diminishing for your future. So the love that we express is we accept that number one, the inner beauty of the human soul has to be respected in any case, whether it's your own child or is anyone else's child. When it comes to your own child because he is something special or she is something special in your lives, it's because he or she belongs to you, he or she is your offspring, is a produce of your body and your soul.
It's a part of you.
It's a part of you. So you need to take special care. But the special care is that you, when you want
also
to
also express actually your anger or you know, when you're not agreeing with something, your disagreement in a particular way. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we have had the pleasure to have Professor Nakavi with us in the studio, and we are discussing the important topic of love to be taught to children, especially the teens.
When we, for example, I always quote the example of a pigeon. When we want the pigeon, when it's young, we normally what they do is they, those who breed pigeons, they cut off the wings, the newborn's wings. So when he grows up, he develops new strong wings with which the pigeon can fly higher. So when we are able to do that with respect to our own children, I mean, it may feel painful. It will be painful for the child It's like giving pain, it's like giving bitter medicine to your child, despite the fact that he is crying and doesn't want to drink it. But you, because of your love for him, you want him to drink that medicine because you want him to become better.
Yeah.
So if you want to, if you don't do that, if you don't try to control him in a manner that he may feel bad about it, but you need to impress upon him or her that we're doing this for your benefit. We're doing this for your
to take you out of sickness.
Well-being. You yeah. need to be. You need to fly high, and to be able to fly high, you need to be. Control yourself. So when the time comes, you can fly. At this time, you're going to fly. I mean, many children, they want to do things which are things which grown-up people need to do, can do. But they want to do things. I mean, for example, we had a video some time ago that's a huge landlord was sitting in the car, a big car, a huge car, and a seven-year boy was driving, and he was sitting beside him. Now, there were many comments on the tweet, on the Twitter, that why is he's a member of the parliament maybe, and he's allowing his child of a seven-year-old child to drive a huge car, putting his life to danger. Now, what's happening? The child would have said, Baba, I want to drive your car. He said, okay, why not? So that's pampering.
To be at the service of the child all the time is pampering.
So you're trespassing upon, you're trampling upon the law, you're trampling upon the fact that, God forbid, he can take you into the ditch.
He cannot see the dangers that you as a parent can see.
So we need to, you know, control things, and we need to tell our child that because we love you, we want you to become strong. But when things to be done are to be done at their proper time, and you need to get prepared for that.
All right. So, Professor, to put everything together, we have said so far, first of all, we have to teach our children, especially our teens, because teens are the ones who actually go on judging people apparently, that judgment on the basis of apparent features is not enough. You got to take a deep dive into the inner features, into the inner attributes of a person, so that you can actually know what kind of person it is. And then you should not confuse liking with loving, because loving is something that also includes the bad part of the person. You actually love someone with goods and bads, all the things. And such children do not develop problems in the married life or in the life ahead when they get into relationships. So, but now what in this episode was much more clearer was that when you teach your child to love people with their goods and bads, that never means that when people are doing wrong with you, do not be showing that disagreement. Do not be showing you're not happy with it. So what is important is that to show your agreement and disagreement all the time, but in a respectful way. So how much is respect important over here?
Yes, it's very much important. It's like one of the hadiths which we have. It says, "Ahabbu ikhwani." I think it's from Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salam. "Ahabbu ikhwani man ahda ilayya uyubi." My best of friends is a person who presents my wrong things, wrongdoings, my mistakes as a gift to me.
All right.
In a wrapping, in a gift wrapping.
Exactly.
In a sweet coating. I want to present a bitter thing, but I want the person to not to lose his respect and his self-pride also. I want to give him dignity, and I want to present that to him, even my child, that, look, you're making a mistake. It's a bitter thing I'm talking about, but I need to maintain his respect also.
Yeah. Oh, well, Professor, thank you so much. We'll talk more about respect in the upcoming session. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.